The holidays are here, baby. That means Thanksgiving's right around the corner, which means I have got to be sitting in my turkey vat, enjoying the sweet feeling of having all that turkey grease and oil and turkey gizzards floating in and out and around my body. It loosens me up. It softens me down. It gets my skin completely moisturized. And even better, it flavors the Thanksgiving turkey in a way that no amount of spices, no recipe that I know of can flavor it. And when my guests get a bite of my turkey, they look at me and they say, "This is you. You dipped in this, didn't you?" And I just smile. What better way for us to celebrate the giving of thanks than by acoustically ingesting this wonderful conversation with author, seeker, philosopher, Mitch Horowitz. We're going to jump right into it, but first this.
Oh Lord, please help me to trim up my pubes. I've sliced up my jewels and I'm feeling confused. Why did I think that the razor I used on my face would work on my balls? These were the last words of my neighbor Frank. If only he'd used Manscaped. Instead, he bled out over the floor, and I don't have a neighbor no more.
Support for the DTFH comes from Manscaped. They're the best in men's below-the-belt grooming, and they offer precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. You could save your own life. You could save someone else's life who right now are staring at their old razor blade thinking, "I'll just use this." It's not the right tool for the job. Over 300 people every single day end up in the emergency room or even worse because they use the razor that they use for their face on their beautiful, beautiful balls, and they end up getting these horrific injuries, and it is filling the emergency rooms up, especially during the holiday season. There's nothing a man loves more than to open up a present and discover a tool that they can use on their precious, 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 precious pairs to ensure that they will not slice themselves, stigmatize themselves, transform the pleasure sac into the third act of carry. And you can be the person who delivers this beautiful tool to your loved one. Right now, you can get 20% off and free shipping with the code Duncan at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use code Duncan. You can clean up your crotch and make Santa proud this year when he catches a waft of that professionally, freshly shaved, scented, creamed, and cared for beautiful, 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 beautiful balls and crotch and taint of yours, which deserves so much love on this Christmas season. Sweet, sweet, darling loves, head over to the DTFH store on Black Friday. That's the day after Thanksgiving for those of you enlightened beings living in caves. And use offer code BLACKTURKEY to get 20% off any item in the store. And we've got brand new amazing stuff. You can click on the link in the comment section of this podcast or click on the shop link in the comments section. We also have a Patreon over at patreon.com/DTFH where you can get commercial free episodes of this podcast along with a lot of other great stuff. All right, here we go. Today's guest is returning, and usually I put a little bit more space in between guests, but I was so blown away by the last conversation I had with Mitch that and he wasn't going to be in town, so we just had to do another podcast, and that's what this is. Dear friends, Mitch Horowitz is a brilliant author who has written many, many books. He most recently wrote a book called Magician of the Beautiful about Neville Goddard, who is this incredible mystic that has completely changed my life. Highly recommend this book. He also travels around giving fantastic lectures on a variety of topics, sometimes Satanism, sometimes magic, sometimes Neville Goddard, you name it. So if you ever get lucky enough that he's traveling around, you definitely go see one of his talks. Check out his amazing books. All the links you need to find Mitch are going to be located at duncantrussell.com. Now, everybody, please welcome back to the DTFH, Mitch Horowitz. Mitch, welcome back.
Thank you, man.
It is really cool that I'm getting to know you. You're awesome. You're like
back at you.
Alan Watts meets Aleister Crowley or something.
I like it.
And it's pretty cool, man. And it's a really fantastic mix. But my the last podcast we did was about manifestation.
Yeah.
And we were texting, and something that I think we came up with that would be fun to talk about is how does manifestation fit in to the various Eastern paths that seem to contain within them a deep, the deep importance of being unattached. The deep importance of not associating with the world, the deep importance of not being caught in the updraft that is materialism.
Yes.
Which in Buddhism, it seems to, the idea is like you can just be sucked into matter like you're in quicksand.
Yeah.
And go deeper and deeper and deeper. And the deeper you get into the quicksand pit of materialism, sure, you'll have power and wealth and everything that you might want, but you'll never realize that you've fallen in love with the anaconda that is strangling your happiness. And so within that, it almost seems like it could be a really valid interpretation of Buddhism to say there is something wrong with desire and fulfilling desires, and that the practice of fulfilling desires, and not just Buddhism. I mean, this is like almost all world religions.
Absolutely.
So is there a way to reconcile these things? Is there a way to reconcile this idea of non-association, non-attachment with the delight that comes from success and from achieving things in the world? Maybe I just am misinterpreting Buddhism. What do you think?
This is a very heavy issue for contemporary seekers, especially in the West, although all around the world. But I think seekers in the West very often get torn in two by this question, because on one hand, whatever path you're walking, let's say it's a path of Buddhism, let's say it's a Vedic path, or let's say it's a Judeo-Christian path, whatever it is, eventually you come face to face with this ethic that you're describing of non-attachment, non-identification, not getting caught up in the world of Caesar, not trading your birthright for a bowl of pottage, as our friend Esau, so we're told, in scripture does. Wow. And then, of course, you have this ethic runs very deeply through variants of Buddhism. Don't get lost in samsara. And it can feel agonizing at times to the Western seeker. And then, of course, people caricature the opposing extreme, usually based in some critique of the secret, saying, well, how can the end point of all spiritual awareness be the manifestation or the selection of a Mercedes-Benz? And so, you know, the Western seeker sort of feels tugged between these two seeming poles. The truth is, in my search, and I have wrestled with this intensely, I felt torn apart by it. I have to say very plainly, in my experience as a seeker, I reject the path of non-attachment or non-identification. I don't think that path, as it's sometimes extrapolated from variants of Buddhism, usually westernized variants of Buddhism, I don't think that suits the needs of the contemporary seeker, and I don't think it responds to the impulse of the individual to aspire, to create, to attain. And I've been torn in two by this, and I had to make a decision because I wanted to come up with a beautiful, poetic, holy compromise, and I couldn't find that holy compromise. I really have to be frank with you.
Wow. Yeah,
I couldn't find it.
Yeah, that, you know, to me, I get really bummed out whenever there's a sense of, no, you know, this has already been figured out.
Exactly.
There's nothing else you're going to figure out.
Yeah.
The great enlightened one spoke these words, and this is the way it is. If you're going to change this shit, you're fucking everything up. You're just trying to, make the great, and this is one of the big paradoxes that you run into, not just in any kind of tradition that has within it the invitation to focus on the impermanence or changing nature of things, but then also has within it a kind of dogmatic attachment to some scripture or way of being. So I was just listening to this, beautiful book. I love it. This audiobook of lectures that Ajahn Chah gave, this great Theravadan teacher. And he really did say something about, the one thing that doesn't change is the Dharma, is these teachings, mm-hmm. This is what the Buddha said, this is how we do it, that doesn't change. And I found that to be so confusing in the sense that, wait, I thought the idea is that everything changes. Everything is in a constant state of transformation. And yet here you're saying some scriptural advice or prescription for how to live as a monk or how to be as a lay person is unchanging in the sense that it feels like there can't be any. So how is this, how do these two things meet? How do these meet? To me, it seems like not a paradox. It seems like a mistake, a fault. A sign of fault. And I love Buddhism because it's so rational and logical.
Yeah.
And it invites you to try to find the fault in it.
Right.
And to me, there is a deep fault in any prescription for pay attention to its impermanence. And yet pay attention to impermanence the way that the scriptures are saying to do it. And you know what I'm saying? It really confuses the shit out of me.
This is where I've come to. And I say this very delicately because I'm only commenting as a 21st century seeker on eons of tradition that emerges from the Eastern and Near Eastern faiths, the Vedic faiths, the Buddhist faith, the religions that were born out of the Mediterranean basin, Christianity, Islam, Judaism. I think that Buddhism specifically, and I focus on that faith because that is a major point of search for many thoughtful Westerners today.
Yeah.
I think there's a very important critique to be made of Buddhism, which could be made of every religion, and it's this. I can fall to my knees in front of the Dhammapada, the Vedas, various commentary and interpretations of them, but it's very important to recall that every religion has been shaped by human hands. They may have been inspired people at the inception, but every religion is shaped by human hands and responds to the social and cultural needs of its geography, of its background, of its of its nascent culture. And when you look at the Vedic and Buddhist worlds as they existed at the time of the inception of these faiths and their canonized ideas and parables and documents and sayings, the individual that was born into the Vedic world had as much chance of exiting or expanding beyond his or her caste as designated at birth as they did of setting foot on another planet. It was a completely cemented, stratified, solidified society. And that was, I think, one of the social crises that Vedic and Buddhist thought was responding to.
Holy shit.
Couldn't change identities. You couldn't shed your skin. You couldn't exit one caste in favor of another. And if you were to do so, it was literally the stuff of fairy tales. It would be the most extraordinary human exception. And to a degree, I think teachings of non-attachment and non-identification while they definitely possess universal gravity, and I bow to it, they were also responding to the circumstances of men and women in a certain time and place. And the ethic of Buddhism itself would tell us, we 21st century men and women have to take a look at that. If we don't, we are just deferring to catechism at a certain point.
Wow, cool.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Well, that is, it's you winced when you were like, oh God, I said it. And for a second, I do think that's an interesting thing, is that I have associated the potential for blasphemy with Buddhism. And I'm worried because I don't want to be offensive, and I don't want to, and yet within at least the scriptures that I've read, there is a invitation to, like, you need to ask these questions. If this is not right, it's not helping anybody. If there's something in this that's fucked up, we've got to, like, look at that and realize, why is it fucked up? So if this is what Buddhism is reacting to, then is the caste system being cemented into a social identity that you're never going to get out of, then I think to myself, okay, so what is the caste system that mm-hmm. we are experiencing today that Buddhism could respond to? Like, how are we cemented into an identity in the West? And it does seem like addiction mm-hmm. to technology and addiction to a kind of... it seems like here in the West there is a sad trick that gets played on people, which is, number one, you might be a billionaire one day. It's like, that's really not going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. That's a caste mm-hmm. system. In other words, like, you probably, and as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, fuck that, man.
Fuck that.
Maybe I'll be a billionaire one day.
Right, right. Yeah.
But then also, but if you really think about it, it's like, well, it's not going to work for everybody because there's limited resources. So we're only going to get a few billionaires.
Yeah.
And it's going to be an infinitesimally small percentage of the population of the planet. So this is a global caste system that you could look at as like wealth, right? And then because of our, the way we've been indoctrinated here into thinking that achieving these high states of, whatever it may be, the realm of the gods, the wealth, the mansion, or whatever, because the indoctrination is, once you get there, you're going to feel better, man. You're going to feel better. You move over there into that place, you're all that shit you're like, that's torturing you right now.
Yeah.
The answer was obviously a mansion. It was just the prescription, or fame, or wealth, or sex, or a car, or the thing. And here what happens is we get it. And then sometimes we realize, oh, fuck, that thing has created more complexity.
I sympathize with that. And yet I have to acknowledge my path is one of aspiration. It is one of self-expression, of creativity. Yeah. And hand in glove with aspiration comes some form of accumulation. And I feel in my heart, looking back over many, many years on the path, working with other people, observing other people's experience, observing my own experience, I honestly don't believe that the Western seeker will ever be happy unless his or her search has within it some aspect of creativity, of self-expression, of attainment. I think it's in human nature, as above, so below, or as it's put in Judeo-Christian scripture, God created man in his own image. We are creators within this sphere.
Yeah.
And shame on me if I point a finger at my neighbor and say, he's got it wrong because he wants to put his name on something. And that's samsara.
Yeah.
I don't know that. That may be a profoundly important act of self-realization for that individual, maybe a profoundly important act of self-realization for me. And I think that we create an orthodoxy almost in reaction to wanting to push these things away in ourselves. And people could say to me, oh, great. So, you know, what are you saying? The whole point of spiritual practice is just to accumulate. Not necessarily. I think the point of spiritual practice is to realize in oneself a sense of functioning with ease, with creativity, with expressiveness, with peak potential, or at least moments of peak potential, and not feeling like we have to disavow seeking a constituency or an audience. I remember I was in a very intensive esoteric group for many, many years, and we would have group meetings, and it was a deeply serious, deeply committed group of people.
Cool.
And there was this one woman telling a story one night about how she had created an ice sculpture outside her house. And she had some friends coming to visit in the afternoon, and the sun was, it was kind of a warm winter day, sunny winter day, and the sun was melting her ice sculpture. And she said she was feeling anxious because she wanted her friends to arrive so they could see this beautiful ice sculpture that she created before the sun melted it.
Yeah.
And she was saying this in these confessional tones, and it was being heard that way by this group of very good people listening around her in a circle. But I felt this inner revolt against her story, and I wanted to say to her, and I didn't find the words until years later, you have nothing to confess in this story. You have nothing to apologize for. You created something beautiful. Every artist wants a constituency for his or her work.
Yeah.
The fact that you want eyes on the beautiful thing that you did that I can't do, to me, is entirely natural, in as much as a farmer wants his crop to have a good yield, in as much as, you know, a poet wants to hit that just right meter on whatever he or she is doing. And I think we can't, we can run from anything, you know, we can run from anything, but to run from that impulse in ourselves, I believe, creates terrible tension. I've never felt more relaxed having come to the realization and being able to enunciate the realization, maybe going back about 2 years, that mine is a path of aspiration.
Well, was there a thing that triggered that realization for you?
There was. I was divided between two teachers. And when you have two teachers, it's like having two spouses. You can never really make it work.
Wow.
And apologies to all the polygamists out there among your listenership. But my impression is that you can't make it work. I was into the thought of two different modern teachers. One we talked about last time, Neville Goddard.
Yes.
Beautiful mystic from Barbados. He lived and worked in America, died in 72. Neville taught, your imagination is God and your desires are sacred and holy. Your desires are, in essence, the voice of God speaking to you. Another teacher, also a contemporary figure, was a man named Vernon Howard, who lived and worked until 1992. And Vernon, like Neville, came out of the mind metaphysics tradition. But Vernon said, as soon as you get attached to the goodies of the world, you've lost, you've checked out, you've bought into all these consumerist values, and you're just reenacting the story of Jacob and Esau being Esau. You're selling out your birthright for a bowl of pottage.
Okay.
And true freedom lies in the direction of non-attachment.
Right.
And you should never allow yourself to get hypnotized by all the pretty baubles of the world. So Vernon's path was just be, just be. There's truth all around you. It can enter you. There's a kind of divine influx. Neville's path was realize your power, realize your power.
Yeah.
And I felt torn in two by these two teachers, both of whom I loved, both of whom I believe offered great truth. And I found that I was volleying between them, and it was tearing me apart. And I eventually had to acknowledge to myself the path in which I felt most comfortable, the path that had a heart for me, was Neville's path, the path of attainment.
Yeah. Well, it is I think that's an important thing to listen to. You know, I have been around some teachers and listened to what they were saying and just felt this dark, dreadful sense of claustrophobia creep into me as you realize, like, oh, in the way they're teaching in their system, there isn't room for individuality. There isn't room for self-expression.
Yeah.
There isn't room for the potential of the, what is it? Terence McKenna calls it the soliton of improbability. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right, right.
You know,
Yeah.
That the chaos molecule that explodes through time and transforms everything. They haven't left room for the fact that that happens on this planet. Is like one of the great things on this planet that happens is that suddenly there's computers It's that's a miracle beyond miracles, and that changes everything. But many of these teachers, they didn't seem to recognize the fact that, well, because they didn't know. The Buddha, God, it's so weird how I feel like superstitious about saying anything even mildly critical of Buddhism.
But
the truth is this, the Buddha didn't know that a meteor wiped out the fucking dinosaurs, man.
Yeah.
The Buddha didn't know that there was going to be a time when we could instantaneously communicate to people all around the planet in a second. Like that Trump UFC video you uploaded.
Yeah, right.
You uploaded a video that you filmed at the UFC of the president getting booed.
Yeah.
And it instantly went around the planet.
Literally around the planet.
These sorts of things that no one could have predicted that. No one could have predicted that, which to me means that there is a potential, regardless of whatever the tradition is that you have prescribed yourself to, there is the possibility that suddenly something inside of you could grow into that tradition and change it forever. And that's exciting, but you're not supposed to say that.
You're not supposed to say it. And people feel it's the result of misunderstanding or it's a skewed Western perspective. But
may I say one thing very quickly,
please,
just to add to what I think you're going to say? I went to I had a conversation with a Hare Krishna when I was really getting into chanting Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
And he said to me, because I told him, I don't agree with this that Prabhupada says here.
Yeah.
And he said, we don't say that we don't agree with his divine grace. We say we don't understand his divine grace.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah,
right, exactly. And at the same time, you're told to verify things for yourself, and yet the trick that religions always use is come back when you've verified the same thing that I've found, and if you don't, go back out there and wander in the desert with the Hebrews.
Amen!
Because you're fucked.
It.
Yeah.
As soon
as
your verification matches what is in these scriptures, then you are one of us. But
until then, you're wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Now, let me tell you a contemporary story about a spiritual teacher, and I want to hear what you think about this, and be blunt, you know, because I wrestled with this for a long time. When I was stuck in this wrestling match, I went to a friend of mine who was a direct student of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who brought transcendental meditation here to the West. And this friend, who had worked for many years with the Maharishi, was just an incredibly effective person. I mean, he was nuclear powered. He would say, you know, I'm going to arrange a benefit concert for the Maharishi, and Ringo Starr is going to be there, and Paul McCartney is going to be there, and Jerry Seinfeld is going to be there. And I'd be like, yeah, right. And 11 weeks later, he's sending me a fucking ticket to the concert. He was just that kind of guy who was so capable and so just effective in the world. And I said to him one time in private, listen, man, you got to level with me. You are the most effective person I've ever met. What did the Maharishi teach you? You know, spill it. Let's hear it. I want the house recipe, because I'm looking at you and you're just dynamic beyond most anyone I've ever met. And he said to me, well, he taught me this, and you can find this in the Bhagavad Gita too. He taught me that you should work, do your very best on whatever you're applying yourself to, and then wash your hands of it. Just forget it. You know, don't get attached to the fruits. Work, be meticulous, be great, but don't get attached to the fruits. And I said to him, I dig what you're saying. But if you organize a benefit concert, for example, you want that room to be full. You don't want fucking Paul McCartney to walk out on stage and be looking at empty rows.
That's right.
You know, that would be mortifying. And he's like, that's true. And I was like, so how do I square this circle? And we talked a little bit more about it. And for me, Duncan, I got to be frank with you. I could never square that circle.
Yeah.
I went back to the Gita. I read the original. I understand the ethic of the teaching. And as a seeker in the 21st century, that teaching places me before a torturous contradiction, like the lady with the ice sculpture. Why shouldn't she want a constituency for ice sculpture? So I wanted to
Okay.
Kind of pass that to you and see what you think.
Love it. Okay. Well, I think probably what he's referring to in the Bhagavad Gita is you have a right to your action. You do not have a right to the fruits of your action.
Right on.
And
right on.
So, but then to me, what's fascinating about the Bhagavad Gita is what you have there is weirdly a mirror of Buddhism, except where Siddhartha Gautama decides to go from the palace out into the forest.
Yeah.
Krishna tells Arjuna, no. What are you doing? That's not the right way. Because Arjuna drops his bow. He's like, I'm not going to fight. It's better to be a renunciate than, spill the blood of our teachers.
Right.
And you would expect, looking at Hinduism, you would expect that the Krishna would be like, yes, go into the woods, give it all up, forget the whole thing.
Right.
It's like, oh, you speak words, you speak wisdom, but you do not understand. And this is the beginning. And also the best verse, the line is, smiling in the midst of these two armies.
Yeah.
Holy shit. That is like death metal.
Yeah.
Smiling in the midst of these two armies that are about, there's about to be, literally be intestines everywhere.
Right.
Smiling in the midst, the divine personality of Godhead said. So that's an amazing thing. And then the invitation is to fucking fight. Because you're a warrior, you're a kshatriya, which fits into your caste system thing. This is who you are.
Right, right.
You have to fight. This is what you do.
Right.
And the reason you're fighting is because they're already dead. I've already eaten them up.
Yeah.
So somewhere within that, I think the way to square that circle is there's an admonishment, not because he wanted to be a renunciant, but because he was being a coward and pretending he wasn't. He was imagining that he was like in some way or another being heroic and brave. It was spiritual bypass in the most extreme way. He didn't want to kill, but that's who he was. And it's the worst thing you could do. And yet God is saying, no, this is your thing. But then also saying on one level, it's you killing. On another level, you're just one of my teeth chomping away at time. And for you to resist this is to resist the reality of that you really don't have much to do with anything at all. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't get to be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's just don't fool yourself into thinking the way you are is necessarily coming from you, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's a flowering of a greater truth in the form of you. So that's why the Bhagavad Gita is, fascinating to me in that it isn't like go and live in with the renunciates. It's like, no, you're a warrior, so fight.
Right.
I don't know if Krishna would have said to Siddhartha, you're a prince right now. Siddhartha didn't know what he was necessarily. He didn't, I don't know. But so to me, it's like you have a right to your action. You do not have the right to your fruits of your action. If you want to be a coward, you could take that verse and give yourself an infinite excuse to fail without shame, to fail without that sense of like, you know what I mean? It's like, if I get off stage and I just ate shit, I don't, and I worked really hard on a bunch of jokes, but because I worked hard on the jokes, if I'm driving home with a big weird smile on my face and I'm like, well, I worked hard on the jokes.
Laughing between the armies.
Yeah. But that's bad because what I need when I'm driving home for me is the sense of like, what the fuck is wrong with me? These people got babysitters. And I went on stage with some shit that I thought was funny and it didn't work.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I've got to work harder. I've got to focus more. And then that's going to inspire better art. So, but, anyway, that's all I'm saying is within these prescriptions is a beautiful way to work. It's like, when you're like purely allowing yourself to just write and to act, it's really amazing.
Yeah.
Without thinking to yourself, man, I hope that this fucking book sells in 5 years.
Right. Because
then all that's going to get mixed in with the art.
Right.
If you just are doing the action of the thing itself, you really do become a pure conduit for the creative energy of the universe. So that's, you have a right to your action. You do not have a right to the fruits of your action. But then if within there, you're like finding a way to like, I don't know, excuse your incompetence or something as a kind of spiritual.
And there, my man, is the Achilles heel of the New Age. It's filled with people. And I apply that term to myself. I don't use New Age in a negative way. To me, it's just therapeutic spirituality. That's not an epithet. But the New Age is filled with people who, excuse a lack of accountability by offering some variant of I'm laid back, I'm unattached, then I reject that. I reject that.
Yeah.
You feel as a performer, you owe it to the guy in the third row who's paid for a babysitter, you know, to come out there and do your job.
Yeah.
And I say bravo to that. I say bravo to that. Our spiritual cultures, our alternative spiritual cultures, are chock full of people who turn the vice of unaccountability into a virtue of non-attachment because they can't water a houseplant.
That's it.
And that
man.
Must be said.
That is it. And that is, to me, that is where, that is, you know, there's something really demonic about that to me, because it's like, if you're failing, that's good in the sense that it means you've put yourself out on a limb.
Yeah.
You tried a thing, it didn't work. You went to the edge and you pushed past the edge and you failed, but fuck, you failed. Like, congratulations, you get to experience failure, when some people don't realize that all their entire life is just failure because they're not trying anything. They're literally built a nest inside a failure tree and they're pretending, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so if you're like experiencing failure from risk, holy shit, congrats, you have gone off the map now. But then don't, like, when you're experiencing that failure, don't then like keep failing. Get better.
Right.
Don't any trick. Anyway, the essence of the thing is, I'm allowed to say this because it's a critique of myself in the past. I figured out a way to imagine that my laziness and cowardice was a revolutionary attitude.
Huh.
Because what is easier than to like be sitting in your own metaphysical muck,
right?
Looking at the wreckage of your life, looking at your abject mediocrity,
right?
Your obvious mediocrity,
right?
And within that, to imagine to yourself, well, you know, man, none of this stuff lasts anyway.
Right.
And I've just turned my back on the world.
Right.
No, you haven't turned your back on the world. You're deeply invested in the fucking world. You're deeply attached to this nonsense, this cynicism, this crap attitude that you've literally figured out a way to lay in diarrhea and pretend you're in a hot tub. That is fucked.
Right.
And that is not a way to be. But that can't happen.
Oh, yeah. Here's a story from 10 days ago. I wrote an article for a spiritual magazine. We made a financial arrangement. They broke the financial arrangement. And the person with whom I was in touch literally said to me, please have compassion for our accounting department. That may be the first time in human history those words have ever been uttered.
Oh my God.
And I thought, how dare you hide behind an ethic of compassion, a very valid, sturdy ethic, to excuse a lack of accountability, to excuse breaking an agreement to somebody who did a service for you. And I thought, I can't cooperate with that. I withhold my cooperation from that. I did break with the magazine, actually, because I thought, it's taking a spiritual ethic and it's turning it into a club to, you know, kind of beat somebody with, the same way some people do that with scripture. And that is, it's taking a violation and turning it into a virtue by way of a trick of language. And it's bullshit.
It's bullshit.
And we gotta get away from that within our spiritual culture. We have, I mean, people might be listening and saying, all right, so you're into aspiration, but where's the ethic in that? I try to do everything I do with what I consider to be an ethic of nonviolence, not by which I don't mean abstaining from legitimate self-defense, but I mean not doing anything that would impede another person's development of his or her own highest potential. So if I break an agreement, or if I disclose something that I agreed was private, or if I just do something that violates a responsibility I have to another person, I have failed. I have egregiously failed. So there is an ethic in this that I think is very important.
Yeah, it's a beautiful ethic. And I think probably this ethic is what would you call it? It's called looking truth in the eye.
Yes.
It's truthfulness.
And reciprocity. Like, I do believe, I do believe all of life is connected. I do believe that things converge. I do believe these parallel tracks that we all seem to run on converge.
Yes.
And so I do take it very seriously. Call it what you will. Call it karma. Call it the golden rule. Call it cosmic reciprocity. My ethic, whether I excel at it, whether I fail at it, the ideal that I'm aiming for is one of reciprocity. I do believe that's very real because we are connected.
Reciprocity, I think, as I understand your, from what I've just, some of your writings, it's a really, I think your idea of reciprocity definitely does not align with the new age movement's general concept of reciprocity.
Yeah.
So I want to cut, we're going to jump to a commercial, we're going to come back and talk about Horowitz reciprocity, because I've read some of your essays on it and I love it. Okay,
let's do cool. It.
Oh, let us fuck tonight, she said to the sailor man. I wanna suck you dry before you go to sea. The sailor man, he cried, saying, oh my darling, I am so nervous that I don't feel a thing.
All aboard! All aboard the Titanic!
I think you know the rest of that sad story. Instead of focusing on his nightly lookout, that sailor had his mind on his love back home. And because of that, the Titanic ran into an iceberg and sank. If only he had had Blue Chew. Blue Chew, it works. I tried it. I wouldn't pitch something like this if it didn't work. And I'm an expert on boner pills. It's made of the same ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. Blue Chew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in a discreet package. So no in-person doctor's visits, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use promo code Duncan. You just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code Duncan to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. So, reciprocity, what came to mind to me is there, and I don't have it memorized, but it's the verse from the Satanic Bible, which goes something along the lines of, like, turn the other cheek. How do you know the one I'm talking about?
Oh, yes, I do.
How does it go?
Anton was not a fan. Yeah, he said you should. Anton LaVey basically wrote, rather than turn the other cheek, you should smash your enemy on the other cheek if someone comes near you with the intent of doing harm.
Yeah, and then he says something on the lines of, like, it's very poetic, the verse, but it's like something like, what good does it do me to get, like, ripped apart by an animal? And
right.
Also, but within it is weirdly a thing of, like, if someone crosses me and I reciprocate, he doesn't say reciprocate, but if I injure them because of whatever bullshit they did, mm-hmm. and they survive, then they gain wisdom. Then I've given them wisdom in this world,
mm-hmm.
and in a weird way have helped the world,
yeah.
because they learned, like, oh yeah, you shouldn't do that to people. Now, to me, it's people get scared when they hear the Satanic Bible and stuff like that, but I've read your essays on Satanism. Many of them I really do agree with.
I appreciate it.
And within it is this beautiful sort of expectation of people in your life to not be assholes to you, and not expect that if they are assholes to you, that you're just going to let that happen, that you're going to allow them to, like, be shitty to you.
Yeah.
And that's what you mean by reciprocity, right?
Well, it's certainly among the things. You know, I describe LaVey and Satanism as positive thinking weaponized. You know, it's really endorsing of the individual's pursuit of self-actualization of self, but also with a sense of what is owed to other people and what is not owed to other people. Mm. What is not owed to an enemy? What is not owed to a destructive person? What is not owed to somebody who comes at you with bad intent? And for me, arriving at my own conception of the satanic has involved a huge historical journey, a huge spiritual journey, but also an ethical journey, because when you start to delve into that way of thought, unless you're just imbibing things that other people have written or other people have laid down, which to me is the most anti-self thing that you could possibly do, if you're a thoughtful person, you're going to have to say, what's my code of ethics? What's my code of honor? What's my code of reciprocity? Yeah. I wrote an essay about this called Satan's Honor Roll, where I felt like I had to assemble a defensible, workable, rubber hits the road sense of ethics if I was going to start swimming in that ocean. And I did my best. I did my best. I think that...
You mean the ocean of Satanism?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, I see.
Because I have my own... perspective. I have my own definitions. I admire Anton LaVey. I admire Michael Aquino. There's lots of people who I admire who have been innovative thinkers in that world. I have allegiance to none of them. I have a very, very different reading of Genesis 3 and the encounter of the snake and Eve in the garden than is the traditional one. I'm very into what you
Can
might
you talk
call-
about that?
Oh, sure, of course. This is the point of view that underscores what could be called romantic Satanism, in which the serpent didn't come to Eve as a deceiver. The serpent came to her as a usurper. And the serpent said, you've been lied to. You've been told that if you eat fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you'll die. Not only will you not die, but you'll gain measurement. You'll gain intellect. You'll gain some sense of self-capacity. She eats the fruit, discovers, in fact, that she doesn't die, that Adam doesn't die, and then the first couple is expunged from paradise, so to speak. But in exchange from being expunged from paradise, they have the capacity for measurement, they have the capacity for intellect, they have the capacity for self-determination. And we're told, oh, but look how tragic it is. Their kids commit this act of fratricide. It could be that friction is the price that we pay for creativity. Friction is the price that we pay for sentience. That may be a polarity of human nature. And everywhere through different systems of thought, whether shamanic or Judeo-Christian or various teachings from different parts of the East, Near East, Far East, the serpent appears as a kind of DNA strand of wisdom,
Ooh,
so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
And the serpent is the revolutionary, the anti-hero, the usurper, the artist. This occurs again and again through human myth, and I think we've stood our own mythology on its head. I think we've misunderstood the parable of Eve and the serpent. So when I use the term satanic, I have a different interpretation than the historically prevailing or accepted one. Mine is closer to an interpretation that was embodied by some of the romantic poets and playwrights who saw the satanic or the Luciferian as that force of Promethean energy, creativity, judgment, usurpation that reasserts itself time and again throughout human history.
Yeah.
That's what I have allegiance to.
Yeah.
And I also have an ethics and a code of honor that I care very, very deeply about that I don't think, well, listen, I'm not going to put on anybody else what they should or shouldn't include in their work. That's up to the individual. But for me, it was really important to lay down that code and to do so publicly.
Right.
Yeah.
That's cool to hold yourself to a standard. And, you know, with Satanism, it's one of the religions that I get so annoyed with people who are bigots towards it. And it's just like, you assholes, like every single Satanist that I've met, they all have this wonderful sparkle to them. They're very alive and exciting to be around and happy or focused and like not always like non-scary, like but you know what I mean? But there's something in it that's very
and they're usually nasty and cool looking and aesthetics must not be left out.
But there's
aesthetics
a real vitality there. There's a real vitality that I really respect and
lazy people don't become Satanists. It's not like, you know, some guy sitting around says, oh, I think I'll try this.
Yeah,
you know? And I'm being glib, of course, but when people critique it, they have no idea what they're critiquing. They're imbibing these ideas that are vastly removed from anything that they've experienced, from anything that they've ever laid hands on. And then they want to know why you're not accepting their premises. You know, their weapon is You should be accepting my premises and arguing for my premises. And I won't do that. I can't do that. So they don't know what it is we're actually discussing. And sometimes they just don't want to know.
Well, I mean, the thing they're critiquing is worthy of critique. They're thinking like Satanists are like eating babies
exactly,
and washing themselves
exactly.
in baby blood.
Right,
and
right.
like, I don't know what, the, crazy shit.
Which crazy is shit like, yes, and fiction.
You
yeah.
should, fiction.
Fiction.
Fictional bullshit. But it's
yeah.
like, if you want to critique that, you are, of course.
Right. I'm with you. Good. We're both against that fiction. Or if somebody's doing that, I'll be the first one to call 911.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe I'll even break down the door. Yeah. You know, will my detractor do that? I'm not so sure all
right.
the time, despite
yes.
the pretty language they use. I have found that I've said to people, you know, if you're on a highway on a winter night and your car is broken down and your cell is dead and you got one pair of headlights coming down that road who can help you out, would you choose me or would you choose one of my most vociferous detractors? I have no doubt what decision you'd make, and that's all the jury I need.
Yeah. Yeah, no shit. Here's the question. If you have to go into a fucking bomb shelter after the apocalypse,
yeah.
you want to go in there with a bunch of evangelical fundamentalist Christians? Do you want to be locked in there
yeah.
with Father Jeffrey Brown? You want to be locked in there? You
or
want
Mitch.
To be locked in yeah, or a bunch of fucking Satanists.
Right, right.
I'm choosing Satanists in the bomb shelter
yeah.
every single fucking time, man, because I know I can trust the Satanists. I know whatever, like, it's also, it's going to be fucking fun. But also, you know what I mean? There isn't going to be the insidious, dark,
right.
authoritarian control mechanisms that pop in whenever you get a centralized religion that,
right.
that is clinging to awful hierarchical. Anyway, the point
no,
is
no. you won't have hypocrisy. You're
yeah,
at least
yeah.
not to the same degree. I mean, hypocrisy is a human problem. It's always going to appear.
It's going to be there. It's
but
not gonna be perfect.
But it can be really pernicious. And when people who hold themselves up as moral exemplars, you know, hold forth, there's always a terrible concealment of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
I don't know who hasn't experienced that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's so disappointing when that pops up. But to get back to the Garden of Eden, well, one side note, I'm sure you know this, you know the descendants of Cain became the musicians, right?
Yes,
East
yes,
of Eden.
I'm sitting with one.
Yeah. The outsiders, I will mark you so that you'll always be outcast, always be traveling.
Right
on. Anyone who's an artist understands that has the mark of Cain, and we
yes.
know what it's like. You know what it's like. You're always
You're
traveling.
You're the outsider.
You're
yeah.
the outsider.
Yeah.
And so I think that's quite beautiful, but this is something I wonder if you have heard of, how... Actually, the Garden of Eden is matches a way that you would test an AI to find out if it was deceptive. So if you wanted to, if you had an AI that achieved sentience,
yes.
you would want to put it into a hermetically sealed chamber
yes.
where it didn't have access to the internet. Because if it had access to the internet, then it would be able to instantaneously absorb all the information in the world. And it would become a million times more powerful than you in that moment.
Yeah.
So you want to find out, is this AI deceptive?
Yeah.
So what you do is you put it in a room where it has the ability to log in to the internet, but you tell it not to. And then if it attempts to log in, you will have seen that it did that. And then you would ask it, did you try to log into the internet? And if it says no, then you've got a deceptive AI, and you can't expand upon it more because it's shown itself to be deceptive, and you know you're fucked with that kind of thing. So
yeah.
the Garden of Eden is actually weirdly a AI,
yes.
a chamber for an AI.
That's
where they're
fascinating.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. And the serpent was some kind of part of the code that was saying like
rogue code.
Virus, maybe.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is the soliton of improbability, which is like, you know, within the Gnostic fucking confines of the soul prison that apparently we're stuck in, there is Sophia, right? The thing
yes.
that descends into
yes.
it
yes.
And illuminates it and says, look, there is a way out of this, that there is another path, there is another thing, but it's never going to look like what the thing calling itself God is telling you. It's going to look so different from that, that just the thought of it is going to be terrifying to people. And that is where I think you become an actual seeker, as you would say.
Yes. And it's understandable why this is terrifying, because in a sense, we human beings, for all our violence and for all our problems and for all the tragedy we inflict upon one another, we're the heroes in that story. We're the heroes in the Prometheus story. We're the heroes in Genesis 3. If you look at it, at least from the perspective that we're working with, we are told, be good poodles. We bite the master. We're not good poodles.
Right.
There's punishment, but we grow and we expand and, you know, ye are as gods, so to speak. And we're so terrified that somebody's going to come along and do that to us. We're going to be in the position of saying, don't you eat from that tree of knowledge and good and evil. And somebody eats from it and we can't control it. And a whole new story begins and we're not the heroes anymore. And that's kind of scary.
As above, so below.
Yes.
And
right.
Here we are as humanity finding ourselves on the verge of an AI that's going to we can't stop it.
Yeah, we can't stop it.
But we're going to fucking try.
Right.
And that's the idea. That's so it's funny to realize that like... It's our creation.
Yeah. And shouldn't it be grateful to us? You know,
yeah.
I mean, all these things that are expected of Adam and Eve, be grateful, behave yourself. And we're putting this tree in your midst, call it the internet, call it whatever you wish, but you mustn't eat from it. That's the one rule. We're going to take care of you. We're going to make sure everything's just fine. But you can't do that. And the serpent comes along and says, what kind of a god would put you in a garden of so-called paradise but tell you that a tree erected in its midst, which is going to give you advancement, which is going to give you progress, which is going to give you the capacity for self-development, is out of bounds. But there it is. Don't touch it. That's the whole human story in a certain sense.
Yeah.
And of course we ate from it. How could the individual not eat from it?
Knowing... humans, the best way to get them to eat from the tree would be to have a snake appear and say, don't do it.
Exactly.
It's a trick. And also, you know, this is the thing I love in like some of the Gnostic interpretations is like it turns everything on its head. So it's like actually the serpent was God. The serpent was God. God appearing within a creation that, do you know this story in Buddhism? It's, I'm sorry if I already told this, and it stopped me for real. I'll tell it very quickly.
Yeah.
So Buddha's about to gain realization, and Indra, the king of the gods, appears. Buddha's about to gain realization. He's getting all these cities. So he goes to visit Indra, the king of the gods. He appears in Indra's palace, this famous, beautiful place. All the other gods are sitting with Indra. Indra says something on the lines of to Buddha. You can't be here right now. I didn't expect you. You're an unexpected. We can talk, but this isn't the time.
Mm-hmm.
So Buddha's meditating under the Bodhi tree. Indra appears to him and says, listen, I'm sorry that I threw you out, but here's the deal. Because Buddha, prior to realization, was going to entreat Indra to end the suffering of human beings or to tell him, how do we end the suffering of humans?
Okay.
So Indra says to Buddha, here's the deal. I was just the first one here. I have no fucking idea where any of this shit came from.
Huh.
The gods think of me as their father only because I'm older than them.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to tell them that like this stuff was here before me. So can you figure out how to end human suffering? Because I don't know how to do it.
Oh, wow.
It is so beautiful.
That's wild.
So Buddha immediately gets shoved right back in his face, the thing he was hoping to give to God. He gets literally the most terrifying message you could get from God, which is like, yeah, I'm as confused as you are, man. And I've been fucking lying to the gods telling them I made this shit. I don't know where it came from. I need your help.
Right.
What?
And if one takes that story seriously, if one really takes that story to heart, then who are the so-called religious leaders or devout whose position it is to define to any of us our search?
Yes. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, I love the various ways that Krishna appears in the mythology. Like, you know, in the Leela of God, is Krishna will come to you as a friend, a lover.
Yeah.
Or a baby.
Yes.
Most helpless thing ever.
Yes.
And if you, sometimes I really do think like, oh my God, the assumption is there is some super intelligent divine being that is just running the show, knows everything.
Uh-huh.
Really, all you have to do is surrender to that entity or allow yourself to be the, quote, conduit of the thing.
Yeah.
But what about this one? what if that thing that we think is so great is actually dying, needs help,
yeah,
completely vulnerable,
yeah,
completely lost,
right,
has no idea what to do, like an elderly parent,
yeah,
that needs you to change its diapers.
Yeah.
And this whole time we've been like leaning into this idea. Have you ever been around a powerful person who's going insane?
Yes.
And
yes,
you really, and you watch as the powerful person's going insane,
yeah,
the sycophants try to keep enacting the powerful person's desire into the world.
Yes.
But they know that, that by enacting that, they're actually hurting the powerful person.
Yeah.
As above, so below.
Yes.
Who are we to say that it hasn't gotten to the point that whatever started this entire process isn't slowly losing its fucking mind,
mm-hmm,
and is depending on its children not to worship it, but to fucking change its diapers,
yeah,
to scrub it down,
yeah,
to put it in a nice bed,
yeah,
and to allow it to blink out into non-existence in a sweet way,
yeah,
instead of imagining that the buglings of history, the crazy don't eat shellfish, stone,
right,
gay people,
right, right,
that,
right,
sounds like a crazy person talking.
Right, right, right. You know, it strikes me as we're talking about this, why, when we speak about verifying things for ourselves on the spiritual path, we can't just talk about that in some immature way, or we can't just use verification as a substitute for agree with me, because if your verification is successful, you'll come around to my,
right,
point of view. I want all of us to really make a legitimate, sincere effort towards verification and not to speak about shit that we haven't experienced.
Right.
Like, I don't want to hear somebody who hasn't experienced riches or fame tell me about riches or fame. I won't tell somebody about war or the Holocaust or 9/11 or things,
right,
that I care deeply about,
yes,
but that I haven't experienced.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want anybody to tell me about what thought vibrations were occurring among people who experienced the hurricane in the Philippines, because I've never been through a life-threatening,
right,
hurricane. I can speak about things that are in my own purview, which is what I've tried to do, you know, during this exchange. And I really want us to, when I say us, those of us who are on the path, who work together, who study together, let's verify things in a radical way, but let's hold ourselves to that for real and not talk about shit that we haven't experienced.
Fuck yes. You know? Basic, simple, but so powerful. And what a relief. Because you know when you're talking about shit you haven't experienced,
oh,
it feels,
I hate it,
so bad.
Yeah.
You probably don't do it anymore, but anytime I'm watching my fucking mouth, my lips flapping as I'm going on and on about, like, because as a, you know, I think that's, I'm a fool. I'm a comedian. I'm a fool. I'm a professional fool. So a fool will flap its lips over. I've caught myself like describing like crazy shit, like trying to describe like cellular mitosis to people, just allowing my lips like that, that, that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Listening to me like, you're literally just making shit up right now, and it's only embarrassing you.
Yeah.
Because people are looking at you like, all right, you're going to talk about mitosis right now?
Right,
why,
right.
But I love this ethic of like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Just say what you know.
Yeah.
It helps everyone so much more. And what you know is powerful. You learned all this because you have this unique subjective experience of being a you. What do you know?
Right.
Show us your maps. I'll show you my map.
Right,
we'll
right,
figure
right.
out where, what's going on here. But fuck.
Yeah.
Please, for God's sake.
Right.
Don't show me
right.
a goddamn map of a place that you only heard someone talking about.
Hey, fucking man. Like King Midas can tell me about wealth. I want to hear from King Midas because
yeah.
he knows about that shit.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear from my neighbor Mike who doesn't know anything about it, you know?
Yeah.
And I could extrapolate any number of things from that. And I have to be careful with that, you know? One of my kids said to me just the other night, my son Toby, who's 12, he said, Dad, I've been thinking about this. I don't think you should be tweeting anymore about politics. And he said, wow. Not because I'm down on what you want to say, but because there's enough people doing that and you've got all kinds of different people interested in your stuff and you don't want to really divide them in two. And I was like, all right, I dig that. I dig that. There's a lot of people out there who could express whatever my political viewpoints are better than I can. Let them do that. Like, let them do that.
Yeah.
I'll fuck up and I'll tweet about politics tonight, you know, but but it struck me as a good idea. It struck me as a good idea because why? Why? I care about politics. I have my point of view. I have my my things that I want to see get done in the world. I have policies that I like. But there's hundreds of thousands of people who could tweet about that better than me, who live it, eat it, every day. Let me tweet about ESP research. They don't have to do that.
Well,
I'll do that.
To me, I like what Toby said to you, and I think it's good advice for any of us. But, you know, which is essentially some version of like, stay in your lane, Dad.
Yeah.
But, and I, you know, as many times as I've desperately wanted to tweet some political shit,
yeah,
I've thought the very same thing, which is like, I really don't understand this enough to make a commentary on it that isn't anything more than a super diluted version of something somebody else is already saying.
Yeah.
But also I think like, this is my area of I think it's very highly revolutionary and political to put ideas into the world that make people feel empowered and liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that transcends the state. I think anytime you put out into the world anything that helps a person push off the imaginary manacles holding them to a mediocre life,
yes,
you do all of the stuff that people wanting the state to change do, but in a much deeper way. Because as Carl Jung says, the state is when fascism and tyranny, this is a shadow manifestation in the gestalt. You know, the gestalt manifests as its shadow appears, appear as the leader.
Yes.
Meaning that working on the state and government and getting politics right and figuring out a way to get healthcare for people and all the stuff we want to see happen is a beautiful and noble pursuit.
Yeah.
But that's addressing the flowers that are growing out of a much deeper, the garden that's growing out of, you can get into the seeds.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what people like you do, which is you give us knowledge of things we haven't heard before that liberate our minds and make us feel empowered and make us feel like, oh shit, it is okay for me to want to make money. And it is okay for me to want to live in a nice place. And it is okay for me to enjoy having a nice car. I don't have to feel guilty every fucking step of the way to my grave. I can actually enjoy my life. And the moment you do that, and a person absorbs that for real, you really do fuck up any kind of authoritarian power structure that depends on fear to control people.
Yeah.
Because now you've made a fearless person. And there isn't anything more absolutely abhorrent to fascism than someone who's not afraid.
Right.
So you know what I mean? So it's more effective, I think, for you to put this data out there. And it is political.
Yeah.
It is innately political, but you don't have to like talk about the Electoral College and shit like that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And if those seeds are planted and the individual has a greater sense of his or her own possibility, then who am I to say to them who to vote for or what to endorse? I mean, they are fucking sentient beings. Yeah. Let them decide that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a relief.
Yeah.
That's
right.
The other thing.
Bravo.
There's something so fucking, it's such a relief to just realize, like, I didn't go to college to study politics.
Right.
I don't, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I read Salon.com and Politico and Reddit. That is not enough for me to be a pundit.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I do study Buddhism and I do study mindfulness. I love comedy. These are things I could talk about in a way that is meaningful. So I love what you're saying. And I think it's like, if you want to do tweet all the political shit you want, you know what? Go ahead. Everyone's doing it. Who gives a fuck?
Right.
It's like, we're all like doing it, you know, but sometimes I think of that as like, by the way, what's your time situation here, man?
I am cool.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So I mentioned this on an earlier podcast, but I grew up in St. Simons Island, Georgia, or I spent my childhood there, and I go back there sometimes, and there's these fiddler crabs. They make these nests in the mud, and if you walk by their nest, they'll wave their claw at you to, like, because I guess they think it's going to keep you away. I don't think they're waving hello. It's like, get away!
Yeah.
But you see the claw waving, and you realize, like, I'm a giant to these things. Like, if I wanted to, I could just pick up a log. If I was some fucked up person, throw it on their nest, and then all their claw waving wouldn't do anything. And so there's a sweet, to me, poignant thing happening there, which is in the midst of this monster walking by, they're heroically waving their claws, but ultimately an impotent gesture to an alien thing that has no understanding of their society.
Yeah.
Similarly, this is what political tweeting looks like to me sometimes.
Yeah.
Just the waving of a claw in the face of a fucking projection of our shadow or something like that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do much except make your arm tired. It makes you seem sort of pointless. You know, whereas like to me, like what you do, and this is kind of something I want to talk to you about. You're in it, man. You're coming here to do a lecture tomorrow.
Right.
Every time you're in town, you're giving these like, you're really teaching. You have taken the mantle of a teacher. You're doing that now. You're giving lectures. You're giving really good lectures too. You're like, when we talk, you're informed. And what's coming out of you is focused, organized, and like, refined. And it, like, you know what I mean? It's entertaining, but it's informative. And it's really cool to see that version of it, man. That's really, really quite powerful. And so to me, that's getting into the guts of the thing.
Yeah.
It's getting out of your fucking house, getting into your community, getting out there and really doing it. You're interactive. You're tirelessly interactive. You're like, you know what I mean? You're working so hard to do this. So clearly you feel some kind of call, right? You feel like you feel it, man. You kind of feel this sense of like, shit, I'm kind of like Neville Goddard. I'm kind of like that touring, teaching, lecturing person.
I always dug the barnstorming troubadour side of Neville. Like Neville had no significant business apparatus at his back. He just gave his lectures. He wrote his books. He did his shit. He permitted it to be freely taped and so on. And I really, really admire that. I have to confess, the business apparatus that exists at the back of some of the spiritual teachers today is so fucking boring to me. You know, I could just break down in tears of boredom when I encounter it from time to time because it's so studied. It's so safe. Everything is trademarked, and there's the HTML newsletter, and Neville was an anarchist. Neville was just wild and crazy in the most wonderful way. He just bopped around and barnstormed, and that's been the greatest inspiration to me. Absolutely.
Yeah, man. And that's what you're doing. And to me, that is the like, we all, it's like that, like, okay, what do we all want? What does everybody have in common? We all want to be happy. This is the reality. Like, if you don't want to be, if you're lying to yourself, like, no, I don't want to be happy. Shut the fuck up.
Right.
You want to be happy.
Right.
Everybody wants to be happy. The people who loved fucking Trump, guess what? They want to be happy.
They want to be happy.
And
I've seen so many spiritual teachers steal that question from people. Somebody raises happiness and they're like, well, which I wants to be happy? Which part of you wants to be happy? What you call happiness is samsara. I don't buy that. I don't buy that. I think it's a basic part of the human constitution. And I told a kid once who was talking to me, let no one take that question from you. Don't permit yourself to be embarrassed out of that question. That could be the question that opens up your whole life.
You know? Right. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. And to me, that all my feeling is that this is to get back to maybe wrap it up on what we started on in Buddhism. And there's like, I really like this idea of like, if you don't worry about, don't try to make yourself harmonious.
Mm-hmm.
If you become attuned to the truth, harmony will follow.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about that because the universe is harmonious.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that is making you not experience harmony is not a malfunction of the universe. It's that you're not connecting to truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a surefire way to know if you're feeling bad, really bad, if you've got a bad mind and you're all crazy, it's you haven't tuned into the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and from that tuning into the truth, harmony follows. But now, forgive me, because this is a really obnoxious question. If that statement is true, if you agree with that, and if you don't, feel free to shoot it down.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the truth that you think people should try to harmonize with. What is that? What is the synopsis of it? Is it synopsable? Is it summarizable? And if it is, what do you think that is for us to like start really trying to commune with the faith that harmony will follow?
I think very often truth or its absence gets reflected in our environment. And I have labored in environments for decades where I was profoundly unhappy, ridden with anxiety. And I kept trying to persuade myself, it's not out there, it's in here. And yet, as above, so below. These divisions are artificial. We create these divisions.
Right.
And I would say to the individual, if you're in a situation where you feel like you're surrounded by cruelty, or you feel like you're hitting dead ends, or you feel like you're being made to feel afraid, your feelings are valid.
Oh, shit.
You don't have to fix yourself. Don't create these fake divisions.
Yeah.
Go to some place where there's better tasting water. And if you can't physically go to that place, make a vow that at the first possible opportunity, you will do so as a physical fact. Listen to your environment. Listen to yourself. Don't let that be taken from you, because I think that these divisions that we create are fake. They're artifice. And that if you're experiencing something that's miserable, it's probably because you're in a situation where the doors of perception are not sufficiently cleansed, and you should trust yourself and feel at liberty to pick up the fucking roots and go somewhere else at the first possible chance.
Woo! Hallelujah! Thank you so much,
pleasure,
Mitch.
Man.
What a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you?
Oh, you can go to my website, mitchhorowitz.com. I'm on Twitter. I've finally gotten on Instagram, and I'm bopping around all over the internet. Just throw my name into any search engine.
Cool, man. Thank you, Mitch. What
pleasure.
A pleasure. Thank you. A huge thank you to Mitch Horowitz for coming back on the DTFH, and much thanks to our sponsors, Blue Chew and Manscaped. Support our sponsors because they support us. Sign up for our Patreon over at patreon.com/DTFH. And if you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe, won't you? All right, we'll see you real soon. Until then, Hare Krishna and happy Thanksgiving.